My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Now, Richard King is my guest this week. Rich is Professor Emeritus of Buddhist and Asian Studies at the University of Kent. I've known Rich for many years, and he talks us through the different places where he has worked. He would never have imagined having the career that he does when he was young, and he talks about how no one in his family had stayed in education beyond the age of 14. He might have ended up, we learn, as a road sweep. His parents were aware of their class background and how the programmes that you watched when you were growing up said something about your class. His earliest memories entail reading out the words in a newspaper. He remembers having the radio on in the house. He remembers swivelling his hips to Elvis. His first album was from The Police. He has a particular fondness, we learn, for 70s music. He became a Doctor Who fan in later years, and it became an important signifier of his identity when he was living away from the UK. We learn why Rich chose to go to the University of Hull and why he felt comfortable there. We learn how he became fascinated with philosophy and what life is all about. He was excited by alternative ideas and Eastern philosophy, and his degree ended up becoming a career that he wanted to pursue. Rich talks about why he has always favoured the underdog in the playground and in the context of colonialism. He became politically aware due to his reaction to Thatcherism, and we talk about how activism has come back since Jeremy Corbyn. Ideology matters again, but Rich says why his vote has been largely irrelevant and why he's waiting for change. We discuss whether painful experiences can be enriching, and we talk about excavating an alternative history that didn't happen and how we can imagine the world differently. We find out if Rich is happy with the things he has achieved and what he would say to his younger self. Then at the end of the interview, we learn about Rich's friendship circle, and he quotes Edward Said about how the only place he really felt at home was inside a book. And we learn about Rich's problem with binaries and how you have to look back in order to know where you are going. It was so wonderful to catch up with my good friend Rich King for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy.
And it is wonderful to meet up with Richard King, who until I think about a week ago was one of my colleagues at the University of Kent. So, Rich, you have been at Kent for what, 7 years?
Yes, I came down to Kent from Glasgow in 2013.
Yeah, and you were at Glasgow, and also before that, of course, I always think of that song, Vanderbilt, isn't it? But I always get it mixed up with the Simon Park Orchestra from the early 70s, but you were, which was the Dutch TV detective, but you were in Tennessee, is that right, for a number of years?
Yeah, that's right. In a, like some of my book chapters, I'm all over the place. I began my career in Stirling in Scotland, where I was there for 10 years. Then I moved to Derby for a 2-year period before that department was closed down. And then after a period of living in Paris as a stay-at-home dad, I got a job at the University of Vanderbilt in Tennessee, in Nashville, where I was for 5 years. And then I came back to the UK in Glasgow. And then from Glasgow, I came to Kent.
Yeah, and a circuitous journey. And one of the things I'll ask you later is whether you could ever have imagined when you were younger, even before you went to university, whether this kind of path would have been possible, because hindsight is a great thing, but when we all in life, you know, when you have children who are trying to work out what their path in life is going to be, where they're going to end up, I mean, would you ever have imagined that you would have ended up Derby, Stirling, Tennessee, Canterbury, and whatever is next in line?
No, not at all. In fact, it depends when we start from, but certainly as a child and a teenager, I would never have imagined that I would have had the career that I had, because I came from a very working class family in southwest London. No one in my family had stayed in education past the age of 14, let alone 16. And so to go to university, to do a PhD, to become a lecturer, to become a professor, all of those things were not things that were on my radar at all as I was growing up.
Yeah, because I've always found, I mean, similar in that sense, because my sister and I, who actually, funny enough, have both ended up in the same profession in academia, but we were the first in our family to go to university. So it felt a very odd, very exotic thing at the age of 18, in her case, late 80s, in my case, early 90s. But I think the expectations then, and I think for a lot of people I've interviewed, that was a real sort of seismic period because more people were going to university. It was the expectation. Certainly the school I went to, most of us went to university. It was only when I went to university and discovered that a lot of my friends were the only people from their sixth forms or their colleges who went on to university. So there was something about our generation where we were doing something that wasn't available to our parents.
Absolutely. And also, I'm very aware of the fact that I got a free education. One where if you were good enough, if you were passing the exams, if you reached a certain standard, you could get admission to university and you didn't have to worry about tuition fees or student debt later on, apart from the fact that you weren't earning while you were studying usually. But so I'm really aware of that opportunity that I had, which, if I'm honest, probably I may not have taken this direction if that hadn't been the case. Because even going to sixth form, I remember my father didn't want me to do A levels. He said he could get me a job as a road sweep. And luckily, my mother said, "No, well, no. If he's good enough and he wants to do this, let him do it." And I'm very grateful that she took that position because otherwise, you know, I wouldn't have had the career that I had.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it, how sometimes, maybe not being a road sweep, although for some people that might be a dream come true, but it's funny how when you're really young, you have often aspirations. I used to do it with radio and I was obsessed. I thought, this is what I want to do. But of course, practically, it was easier to go to university and stay in university. I think I'm somebody who's good at kind of like staying put sometimes for a long period. I might get a lot of things done while I'm there, but I don't move around. I don't sort of move jobs very, very often. And it is funny how when you're young, you have these ambitions. You don't necessarily realise them. You might channel them. I guess the luxury of our profession is that you can channel, you know, you can do your research, Doctor Who or whatever it might be. You can do research in an area that is also your fandom, your passion. But at the same time, there is also the question, what next? You know, are you going to stay in the same job forever or do you then do something completely different? But also, has the time gone? Has the opportunity gone? Have you missed that particular boat? So I think all of these questions we sort of navigate to different degrees at different stages or all stages of our life. And then you add in family circumstances and also, you know, the risks which are too high to completely jump ship and change profession when you need the money and you've got families dependent on you. So I think it's a very enriching kind of tapestry. But you mentioned the very different expectations from your parents. I mean, what did your parents do?
Well, my mother was a mother and a housewife. She also did jobs. I remember at one point not her being out quite a lot because she was a cleaner for about three or four different people. And for me, one of the joys when I was a young child would be, I think on a Friday evening, she would come home with fish and chips and we would watch The Goodies in the early 70s. So I remember that. So my mother was doing these part-time jobs, but also being a homemaker, as we would say. And my father was a postman. So that was the world I lived in. I lived in a family setup where my parents, I think, were very conscious of their class origin, certainly my mother. And they passed that on to me. When we would be out walking about and so on, I was very conscious. My mother had a very low threshold for feeling public shame. And there were certain ways you were supposed to behave as a child and not show her up. And I was aware of differences between myself and some of my school friends. We would have a sofa, but they would have a settee. And very subtle linguistic differences that, at that time in the early 70s, marked us off as working class as opposed to lower middle or anything like that. Yeah.
No, I was reading a book a few years ago. It was by a commentator who was talking about the way in the 70s, the programmes that you watched on TV were indicative of your class. So he was saying that, of course, people would say, oh, I only watch nature programmes, I only watch BBC Two. And then sort of he said friends of his who would watch ITV were deemed a bit, inverted commas, council house. And I sort of looked back and I thought, that probably was true, looking back, because there was always the whole, you know, Noel's house party or blind date. And of course, the answer that you gave said something about your place in the world and what you're going to admit to. I mean, how different now with my children, who watch stuff on YouTube all the time. They don't watch children's TV. They don't watch live television. Everything is selected by them. But in those days, of course, the programs that you would select were well known to people. But it'd be like, oh, I'd never watch that. That's a different sort of, I wouldn't admit to watching that sort of program. The soap operas you watch, there's something about your class. So do you have a lot of that?
Absolutely. I remember that very well. I remember some people saying they didn't watch ITV. Yeah. and I remember watching quite a lot of ITV as a child and BBC. Yeah. But I think in my childhood, one of the key fault line programmes was Blue Peter or Magpie. Yeah. And so I watched Magpie, and I obviously inherited this from my family, in some sense. Yeah. Always found Blue Peter a bit too bourgeois, a bit too middle class. You know, we don't have things in the kitchen that I can make things out of, and so on. So I was very aware of those kind of very subtle cultural distinctions of identity that were going on in that time period.
I've got this image in my head of you as a six-year-old saying, I don't watch Blue Peter, just a bit bourgeois, so I'll watch Magpie.
Yeah, I'm not sure bourgeois was a concept that I was working with then, but in retrospect.
With the sister of, was it Jeremy Hanley, who went on to be chairman of the Conservative Party. So it's like, oh, that changes my apprehension of what was available in the 70s. But what about things like earliest memories, apart from obviously watching Magpie, or Tiswas perhaps, but what do you remember from growing up?
I think one of the earliest memories I have, I think, as I've reflected on it, has been quite significant in my life, in that I remember being quite young, probably about 4 and a half or something like that, and one day I picked up a newspaper, and I just started reading out the words, and then I looked up, and my parents' mouths were open, like, what? He can read the newspaper? And I was obviously an early good reader. The attention that I got from that moment, I remember it very, very strongly, the sense of, I don't know, maybe you call it pride, but certain parental approval from that moment. I didn't get a lot of parental approval in terms of education because my parents didn't really understand those things, although they were supportive. So I think that was a key moment for me because I then got a sense that perhaps reading, understanding things was something that I maybe had an ability for. Certainly my family thought I did. And that probably propelled me to try even harder and please the teacher.
And what did they make of the profession you ended up in? I mean, they must have been proud of you, but also it would have been perhaps very far up from their comfort zone.
I'm not really sure, to be honest. I published a lot of books, very academic books in a very specialized field, and I would give them copies of these books when they were published, and they would like, oh, this is great, and so on. But and then they would become like artifacts. Like my mother would keep them in a glass cabinet in the living room. But they would never be looked at. There would never be any sense that you could look at the words in them and understand what their son had been doing for the last 5, 10 years or whatever. So they were kind of proud, but proud without really knowing what the world was that I had entered and what it was that I did.
And what about when you were a child in terms of, I mean, obviously we have many conversations around music and film, but were they instrumental when you were growing up? I mean, TV we've covered, but were there particular things like the charts, which for me, that was like so defining in the playground in a way that would never happen now. I think, you know, I always find it very funny that I can, if somebody tells me when they were born, I can probably within a month or so work out what was number one in the charts or something, but I just don't care anymore. I still care about the charts then, but I haven't changed, but the charts, the music has changed around me. But did you buy records? Did music play a big part in your growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my house, the TV or the radio was always on. And particularly in the mornings, I remember the radio being on, and it was probably Radio 2, I think, because I remember growing up listening to basically the popular chart hits of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So I got a kind of good grounding just in that as a kind of background soundtrack to my life. My parents didn't have a lot of music themselves. They had some records. I remember they had some 7 inches, I suppose you'd call them now, or then rather. Cliff Richard, The Beatles, Elvis. I remember I have a very young memory of Hound Dog being played on the gramophone. And imitating Elvis and swiveling my hips and my knees and so on. I had a guitar. I have no musical ability whatsoever, but I would be kind of impersonating him. So I remember doing that. And then as I moved into my teens, started to discover my own music. I mean, the first album I bought was Outlander Stamore Police in 1978. I think I already owned an ABBA Greatest Hits, but I hadn't bought that. And I kind of explored. I enjoyed. You could very much place me in terms of my age with the music that I listened to from that period of time: The Police, The Pretenders, Madness, The Jam. These were the kinds of bands that I was listening to. And then moving a bit further forward, I mean, I like any music that is melodic, or that makes me want to dance. And that probably means that a lot of music that I like, people would today call cheesy. But I still enjoy it, and it was also part of my formation. So when I went to university, when I was 18, I remember, and this is, I suppose, quite an embarrassing thing to admit, but I remember listening to quite a lot of Wham! And along with other things. But it was when I was at university I discovered other things like Pink Floyd, Alan Parsons Project, the whole notion of a concept album that you could sit in your room with a stereo on and kind of experience and think through a story in album form. Those are the kinds of formative experience.
And do you still listen to those same pieces of music? Maybe not to the same degree, but at least you're talking about them now with such affection. Do you still have the original versions that you may have bought back in the 70s or whenever?
Yes, I do. I mean, I have a particular fondness for music in the 70s. I like singer-songwriters. I remember liking Elton John and Billy Joel and Simon and Garfunkel, Joni Mitchell. Later on, I discovered Leonard Cohen. I didn't really experience him when I was younger, but songs of that ilk that were very poetic or melodic or were telling a story in some fashion always appealed to me, and they still do. I suppose I sort of stopped picking up new music in any consistent way from the end of the 20th century. I mean, I still pick things up now, but it's much more difficult unless you go searching for things, or you find, I hear things that my daughter's listening to kind of find new material.
Yeah, because I remember talking to my dad about how for him 1963 was the cutoff. So everything up to that point with Buddy Holly, Lonnie Donegan, Everly Brothers, he loved all that sort of music. But then he kind of lost interest. And kind of the same with me. New Kids on the Block. There you are. Somehow it was just like, I could deal with Wham, I could even just about deal with Bross. And Wet, 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 all that sort of, you know, the boy bands in the late 80s sort of thing. I was aware of that and sort of, you know, was happy to go along with it. But suddenly New Kids on the Block was very different. And somehow I just kind of thought, somehow that's like a generation beneath me, if that makes sense. It was like somehow I've done my bit. I've got my basic kind of repository of music, or sort of, you know, I've been formed in this way, and somehow I don't want to take on anything new. And very interesting how then at that point I used to write down the charts every week, and I just kind of stopped. So once it hit 1990, it's like, I don't want to do this anymore. So it sounds like we all have that cutoff point. It's an age thing.
But for me, although I love music, and I couldn't imagine a life without listening to quality music, it was television as I was growing up that was the real stimulus for me, because I wasn't an only child, but I had a sister who was 9 years older than me, and then later two half-brothers from my mother's second marriage who were 10 years younger than me. So I wasn't quite an only child, but I was I was not, I didn't have a sibling close to my age, so I spent quite a lot of time, you know, apart from playing with friends, by myself. I was really into reading comics and even drawing, and I was terrible at drawing, but I would draw comics and make up stories. And I, there were TV shows that I just lived for as a child. So I like Doctor Who, even though I talk about Doctor Who as something that I'm a real fan of. I don't remember at the time feeling like a Doctor Who fan. It was just one of the shows that I watched. I think I became a Doctor Who fan when it came back because I was living abroad in the US, and it became an important signifier of my identity as a British person. And my daughter was growing up outside of the UK. She was half French and half English, and so I wanted to introduce her to something that was part of my culture and my childhood. But as a child, I remember watching Doctor Who, but not it being my favourite programme. My favourite programmes were usually the US programmes, in particular The $6 Million Man, which I absolutely consumed as a child, and I'm sure was a source of great amusement to my older sister and my mother to see me running up and down in slow motion in the back garden.
Yeah. I'm not going to ask if you still do that, but it is interesting how those kind of interests follow you through almost unexpectedly, or you then maybe at university. And it happened with me with Doctor Who. I was never, well, maybe I kind of was really into Doctor Who. I used to buy all the annuals, and we'd all have our debates in the playground about who was our favourite Doctor. I mean, you even act out, I'm not joking, like at the age of 7 or 8, we'd be like, you'd be John Pertwee, you'd be Peter Cushing, you'd be William Hartnell. Looking back, it's like, what a strange, weird game to have played. But we kind of did those things, because we used to watch all those five Doctors or whatever in the programmes. But then at university, there was a Doctor Who society, but it was people who were really, really into Doctor Who, but they were into the science behind it, and that lost because we watched all those old episodes with Tom Baker. It's like, oh, this is way above me. So when I was young, I sort of just enjoyed the concept of it. But then I was a little bit older, and I realised that actually there was a lot more going on in it, and it kind of passed me by, and I just thought, no, I'm a humanities person. But it's very interesting, but looking at the same thing from a different vantage point. So that was never quite my thing later on to the same degree that it was in childhood, but music most certainly was. And what about in terms of how you ended up entering academia? How did that all come about? Because you say that you did your A-levels, but was there a culture in your school of assuming that university was the next step, or was that something you had to fight even harder to accomplish?
I don't remember having to fight to accomplish it, but I went to a kind of what I suppose you call a bog standard comprehensive in southwest London. And some people went to university, the majority probably didn't. And so I very much understood. I had a thirst for knowledge. I wanted to learn more. But I also think I understood that if I wanted to escape the kinds of destinies that seemed to be stacking up for me, I needed to get out. And going to university was that avenue for me. So, and I also made the decision. I went to the University of Hull, so I went up north, get away from the south. I think, looking back, I chose the University of Hull because it's quite a working class university. I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time. I just went there and felt comfortable. I thought the people were friendly. It didn't seem too intimidating. Places like Oxford and Cambridge would never be anywhere I would imagine feeling comfortable, certainly at that age. And so I went off to the University of Hull. I mean, I was the kind of, as I suppose many people who become academics in these kinds of fields are, I was kind of quite intense at 17 and 18. I remember being up the pub with friends, because of course we were drinking at 17 or 18, and thinking, okay, we're about to embark on adult life. Why aren't we talking about what life is about? What's the purpose of our lives? Why are we here? What have the great thinkers of history said about this? And why aren't we exploring that before we then make decisions about what we're doing in the rest of our life? So it was through that avenue that I basically became interested in philosophy. That and my A-level Latin teacher, who knew that I was interested in these questions, and he said, have you ever read any Plato? So he gave me Plato's Republic, which I fell in love with, and then I bought all the Penguin Classic translations of Plato, Platonic dialogues, and I consumed those, and I realized that philosophy, discussions about what life was about, was what I wanted to do. But I also, I think by that stage, from about the age of 14, I'd become interested in anything alternative, really. I'm not a very alternative person in the sense that I'm not the kind of person who, certainly at that age, would have had external signs of alternativeness, like piercings or tattoos or whatever. I probably look quite conventional, but inside, I was excited by alternative ideas of all kinds, like political, philosophical, and it was through that I discovered what at the time I would have called Eastern philosophy. And I thought, I love this. I want to understand it, where it comes from, what it means, what these different traditions are about. And in order to do that, you can't really do that in a philosophy degree. You can only do it in religious studies. So I made the decision to apply for a joint degree. And I did philosophy and what was called theology at the time at Hull.
Yeah. And it's worth saying as well that you brought into play a degree program in global philosophies, which is such a fantastic way of exploring those questions, but not necessarily in a way that could be seen as straitjacketed, as in, you know, I want to study something where religion may play a part, but I don't want to do a degree that studies religion, sort of thing. So I think that it shows the continuity of scale and sort of asking those big questions, which maybe you're probably like me, and at university suddenly you thought, oh, I'm allowed to ask this question, and you haven't got a teacher who says, no, this is the answer, or, you know, the sort of right or wrongness of it. It's sort of like, well, go away and research it, and rather than say which is the right answer, look at what Plato thinks, or Marx thinks, or Freud thinks, whatever it might be, and then you find your own way through that literature. It sounds like that's exactly what you did.
That's right. And for me, the pivotal moment was at the end of my first year at university, when I went in to see the end of year results of the exams, and I'd done very well. In fact, I was top of the year, and at that point, that was the first time I thought, hey, actually, I'm good at this, and I want to keep doing it. I don't want to stop being a student. I want to continue exploring these ideas. And I think from that point onwards, I started to see my university degree not just as something I want to study, but as a career that I want to pursue.
Yeah, I always find it with our students now that for some of them, the degree is a passageway. It's all, well, there's a destination, and the objective is to reach that destination and then do something else and put it behind you. It's a means to an end. And then there are the others who really see that the journey there is part of it. And I guess, you know, it's a metaphor that applies in lots of other circumstances, that, you know, if you're somebody who likes travel, the destination is important, but the journey there, the idea that you just press a button sometimes and get, you know, sometimes you say, well, I cut out all the travel bit, but the travel gives you the opportunity to see the world through a different lens. But I think university can do the same thing. And I guess the fact that you ended up staying in academia shows that obviously that was the way that you saw things. But was that very different from your contemporaries? What about people who taught you there? You know, how influential were the people who taught you at university? What sort of cauldron were you in? What sort of ideas were you exposed to, and how did they influence you?
Well, the two departments that I worked in at Hull, one was very analytic philosophy, and it was also very Western and very modern philosophy. I remember doing a course on Plato and Kant, but basically it was modern analytic thought. And then in the theology department, as it was called, it was mostly theology and church history, but we had one lecturer, Daniel Mario, who was a French academic, who was, I think, to some of my peers, impenetrable in the sense that he had quite a strong French accent, even though he'd lived in Hull for many years, but he was also quite rigorous in the level at which he kept his lectures. And so everyone was struggling in his lectures, but those people who were really interested in the topic and wanted to go away and read more about it, I found that immensely stimulating, and it was really as a result of Daniel Mario's input that I wanted to continue and do a PhD, and then went to religious studies department in Lancaster, which at the time was the kind of leader department for the comparative study of religion.
Yeah, and of course a huge influence on Kent, with many colleagues before you came here who were very much trained at Lancaster. It was the Lancaster model which very much, you know, even to the point when they retired, was still very much the grounding influence. So Hugh Ninian Smart and so on. But what about things like politics? Because Hull, I think of John Prescott, he would have been, was he the, I don't know if he was your MP, but he would have been one of the Hull MPs. But Hull politics, was that sort of a big sort of place for political activity?
I think a few years ago, I was going through some old things that I had in a box, and I discovered the Student Union Freshers book, and I from the first year, and I went through it, and I looked at they had a page on the student societies, and I'd highlighted with a pen the societies that I wanted to join. Most of which I think I never ever went to, but they were all left wing causes like CND and Third World First and things like that. And so I clearly wanted to kind of get involved in those projects at the time, but I didn't, in the sense that I studied. I was a good student. In that sense, but I was very much interested in those questions, and those questions have never gone away for me. I think for me, much of my work is about, some of my work is about post-colonial revisionism, of rethinking how we represent traditions like Hinduism and Buddhism as a result of colonialism, and that can get very conceptual and very complicated, and I enjoy all of that complexity. But essentially, I think it comes down to, for me, to the fact that I have a tendency to always want to support the underdog and to stand up to the bully. I remember as a child, my mother was the kind of person who we'd be walking along the street, and there would be some kind of altercation, some teenage boys picking on someone else, and she would stop and she would go up to them and she'd say, "Why don't you pick on someone your own size, even if they were like 2 foot taller than her?" And of course, that was a risky strategy. It seemed that on every occasion, my mother's fierceness in those moments, and also the fact that she was 5 foot 2 and a woman, shamed them in some way or embarrassed them enough that kind of dissolved the situation. But I very much picked up from her this sense that we should always help people and always stand up for the underdog. And for me, all the work that I've been doing, it really comes down to that basic value, because colonialism essentially is one nation bullying another. A very, very simplistic way of putting it, but that's essentially what that unequal power relation relates to. And so much of my work has been about doing that intellectually, the thing that my mother taught me as a value on the street, if you like.
Yeah, and in that sense, in terms of activism, I mean, obviously, it's impossible, not least through social media, kind of not to either have a voice or decide not to have a voice in the sense of how you want to promote yourself. But I mean, I think I remember many years ago, a student I taught before I came to Kent, who'd done a degree in the 60s, so she came back in probably when she was in her 50s or 60s to do a second degree. She said in the 60s, the students were always on marches, they were always on the street, there was always a cause that they'd be fighting for. In the early 2000s, the students were just not politically active, they were not engaged, and in many cases quite ignorant of, you know, the Gulf War or the Iraq War. It's sort of like this was all going on, but nobody really had a particular stand, nobody talked about it. And students didn't really vote, or they didn't talk about voting. But how that all changed, particularly after Jeremy Corbyn was elected, and suddenly, you know, even though he was in his late 60s at the time, suddenly the youth vote, the students, were really quite galvanised by that, in the same way that you have had in America with Bernie Sanders. So there is something that is almost like what's going on online, and also in terms of actual physical activity in marches, it's kind of replicating what was happening in the 60s. And there was a period when I was a student when that was a pretty blank area, really, a grey area. People just weren't interested in politics, and it's sort of we've returned to something from a different generation.
I think that's right. I mean, for me, I became politically aware as a result of Margaret Thatcher. It was a reaction to that shift, that Thatcherite shift, the neoliberal move, the privatisation. I was very conscious of the struggle between the early Thatcher government and the miners. My stepfather didn't have a lot of money, but I remember him donating to the miners' fund when you know there were mining families who were starving because of that, and so my political consciousness again was a kind of reaction against a certain kind of conservative philosophy. I think that there was a kind of numbing effect that happened culturally with a generation, and that's partly, I think, not completely this, but in the latter part, it's definitely related to putting people in debt. If you put people in debt to a system, then they're preoccupied about the fact that they've got to pay off these loans, whereas I remember a much more active student population when I was going to, and before in the 70s and so on. I think you're right. I mean, I think since Corbyn, there's been an element of that coming back into the population, and for good reason too, because I think in a way that has never been the case for our generation, the generation that are coming through universities now are looking at their future. And thinking, well, what have you done? where is my future? Where are the jobs? How am I ever going to afford to own my own property? The Thatcher promise, if you like, that people could buy their own properties. That appears to be dissolving. And we have the whole climate emergency, and a political system which, in my view, is no longer fit for purpose. And so it's quite right, I think, that people become more politically active because, you know, things have to change.
And my confession at the moment, I'm reading the autobiography of Roy Hattersley, and it's very interesting because he was around in that very period in the 70s, and he served in the Callaghan government and then has particular views about what then happened in the Labour Party. And he talks about that idea that I find fascinating in film about the broken line, the idea that suddenly it was Healey who was supposed to succeed Callaghan rather than Foote, and that if it wasn't for Foote, you wouldn't have had Kinnock and so on. So it's that sort of idea that people within a broad church organisation can sometimes say, but this isn't the direction of travel I want to be on, but do you stay, do you go? He very much stayed and was really didn't like what happened. He blames actually all the evils of Thatcherism on Shirley Williams and David Owen, because he said that in splitting the Labour Party, they contributed to more years of the Labour government, even though previously he was very close to Roy Jenkins, for example. So I find this really interesting because of the parallels with what's happening in the Labour Party at the moment. And then it was the militant tendency, now Momentum. But just sort of looking at it, thinking, when people say history repeats itself, in reading this now, he wrote that in the mid-90s, but it could almost be a sort of a lesson in what then happened in the Labour Party a decade or two afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember Roy Hattersley coming to campus at the University of Hull when I was a student and going to listen to him talk. And this would have been in the mid-80s. And there'd been a case of a protest where a policeman had been quite badly injured in the struggle. And I remember there being some attacks from the audience, from Socialist Worker Party members, actually, at the university. And I remember Hattersley getting very, very passionate and replying and saying, my idea of socialism is not beating a policeman over the head. And so on. And so, yes, I mean, we're now in an age where ideology matters again. I mean, it always did. It's just that there was a kind of consensus period of time when all of the major political parties were basically presenting tweaks on the same neoliberal capitalist project. And what happened with Corbyn and with other extra parliamentary movements like Extinction Rebellion and so on, as we're seeing a challenge to that consensus, to my mind, that's a good thing.
Yeah, but I thought it was so interesting when you had would have been after the 2010 election, the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, and the Leader of the Opposition, all of the same age, all in their early 40s, but all being sort of variations of the same. I suppose if we'd had David Miliband or Ed Miliband, you could almost say that they were so in the centre ground that they were virtually indistinguishable. And then just a few years later, you had a very different kind of polarity. And of course, it also made politics interesting again for the first time, for people who may not be politically, you know, when the parties are all offering the same kind of thing, what's the point in voting, is the argument. But nobody could have said in the 2019 election, not least with the Brexit backdrop, that it's a waste of time, that, you know, they're all the same. Quite contrary, you know, was the case. And people then voting in a different way to the way that they voted in previous generations. And so that was what I saw around Hull, actually, in the northeast, voting Conservative for the first time, mining areas in the northeast going blue, which would nobody could ever have anticipated. So it does seem that some of those same debates, you must find that some of the things that you were passionate about in the 80s, you're no less passionate, maybe more passionate about now, because the issues around equality and what socialism means have never gone away.
Yeah, that's right. And in this strange way, I am more passionate about it than I was then, because then it affected me and my future as a young man. And I find it easier to stand up for other people, like my mother in that sense. And so when I see what's happening to the younger generation, the loss of opportunities, the mess that our generation is kind of making of the world and of politics, I'm very engaged by that.
Yeah. And can you remember the first time you voted in an election? I'm not asking you to necessarily say who you voted for, but can you remember the first election you voted in and who the candidates were?
No. I mean, I can tell you. I mean, it would have been a vote for the Labour Party. And it must have been while I was at university. And I would have voted, because I take that responsibility very seriously. But I don't remember the... No. And I don't... Funnily enough, I don't remember it as being...
It was probably 87, actually, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't remember that being a pivotal moment for me. I don't know why. I mean, people often think, you know, and I would imagine people would think, oh, the first time I vote, you know, that's really, really important. I don't remember.
No, and it's so funny. I remember David Cameron talking about how he would have been like 13. I think he's the same age as you, but he would have been when Margaret Thatcher was elected. He barely remembers it. And of course, the people like thinking, but like, you know, you want to be prime minister. It's like you were almost like unbothered by it. You know, sort of like, well, your passion for what came later. It's sort of like, but, you know, what about the people who've been fighting all their lives for a particular cause? But I remember the first time I voted, and it mattered so much. And it was a big thing about whether, first of all, I turned 18 in 91. And if John Major had gone to the polls early, it would have been another 5 years before I could have voted, because of the Gulf War, and he had that surge in popularity. The election happened. And then the big thing was, would I vote in my university constituency? Because it was during the Easter holidays, April 92, when I was in my first year at Lampeter. Or do I vote in my hometown in Cardiff? In the end, it was in Cardiff because I was at home at the time. But it's funny how, and in the end, of course, it wasn't the result. I voted Labour and genuinely thought Labour were going to win. I'd only remembered a Conservative government. I was born under Ted Heath, but I cannot remember Heath, Callaghan, Wilson. But then, of course, the result was a much reduced Tory majority, but another, as it turned out, 5 years of the same. And I remember feeling so sort of disappointed that there was sort of all this expectation, and then it was almost like, oh, we're back to where we were. And I've never not voted in an election, so it's the same as you in that regard.
Yeah, and I mean, I've lived my adulthood from that, for the rise of Thatcher through to the rise of New Labour, and then Cameron. Thanks for saying that we may be the same age.
Yeah.
So I've lived in a period of time where my vote has been largely irrelevant, in the sense that it's not actually delivered any of the kind of change that I wanted and thought that the country needed. And that's happened very recently. I mean, it happened in the 2017 election. It happened in the Brexit referendum where the position that I voted for didn't prevail, and in 2019 as well. So I keep looking at the system and all of its problems and contradictions, and thinking, well, this system clearly cannot perpetuate itself for much longer. Some for very obvious reasons is that ecologically we can't perpetuate the system of consumption that we have. But I'm still waiting for that moment when there's some positive change, and I'm still hoping for it.
A change in electoral system, or you know, or somebody will come to power and suddenly sort of say we need to do things differently, because it's going to be incremental, isn't it? Or is it going to be revolutionary? You know, I suppose what form will it take? It's because that's the thing. You know, why do we vote? Because I remember somebody saying to me, and I took this so seriously. It would have been one of my lecturers who said, and again, this was in the days of John Major, when so many people. That I grew up with were all hoping for a Labour government, but we thought, well, how come we've never had one in our lifetime or our living, the lifetime that we remember? And he was making these analogies with the New Jerusalem, because we were looking at it in the context of something on the Hebrew Bible, and it was this sort of notion of people use that in a political sense. And I could see the inspiration, I could see the parallels. But then sometimes, you know, I voted Labour in 97, but then it's a bit disappointed. It didn't seem quite as radical. Even John Major apparently has said this to Chris Mullin. I read it in Chris Mullin's diaries that Major could never understand why Tony Blair had such a, you know, whopping great majority, and yet was very cautious. You know, he could have done the opposite, and he would have had the opportunity to do that.
Yes, but of course, for me, Tony Blair ruined any kind of legacy that he would have in terms, because there were some things that New Labour did that were actually, you know, very good in terms of like progressive transformation in education and so on, but then of course the whole Iraq fiasco happened, and I think that you know will forever taint his image.
It is really funny, isn't it, how you can have a politician who you can look at, like the first few years were remarkable because everybody pinned their hopes in him. He was the guy who was going to save the country because Labour hadn't been electable for many years. And then by the end of it, he stayed in power. He was still popular. A lot of people who went on to vote or had previously voted Conservative still voted Labour in 2005. But subsequently, of course, Labour in a way became very passionate and very grassroots, and then it didn't win the election. So, and in Canterbury, where we are now, it had a Conservative MP forever. Even in the Tony Blair years, it never went red. And then under Jeremy Corbyn, it turned and remained at the subsequent election red. So, you know, in a way, nobody ever sees these sort of things happening. And I do wonder whether Canterbury is simply anomalous, because it wasn't what happened in Canterbury, maybe because of the student vote, wasn't replicated elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it was a great moment when Labour won Canterbury, because I've lived in so many places where my vote in the system that we have, my vote didn't really matter because I was never going to get the person that I wanted to be elected. Yes, I really remember that well, that day and that election.
Yeah, and it's always funny because when I was at university, the battle was actually between the Lib Dems and Plaid Cymru. So whatever was happening nationally was never really replicated. So I'd have this vote and be very passionate about politics, and yet the candidates who were in the running, were neither of them were going to form the next government. And then, you know, you'd have friends in other cities who were like really saying, you know, this is a marginal Labour seat and we must seek to ensure that Labour wins. So it's funny, almost like being an observer, sort of being somewhere in the world where you can't change the outcome in the same way that you can in a marginal seat in England, for example. But what about, as we start to wrap up, Rich, do you think, as you look back on your life and career, that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Wow. I'm not sure how to answer. How do you sum up a life in that kind of way? I mean, yes. I mean, I've had some difficult times in my life, and some great times, but I'm happy where I am, and I'm grateful for the experiences and the relationships and the friendships that I've had, so I guess overall, I would say why not?
In a way, it's an unfair question, because I've got a follow-up question in a minute, but because it is that whole binary thing, because I've, and we've talked about this in our research interests, that I have a real problem with binaries. And that's why, I mean, actually, when it comes to things like elections, I always have a very clear, I always know who I'm going to vote for. But in that sense, in other respects, sometimes you think, well, you know, some things are good, but not perfectly good. Other things are bad, but not perfectly bad. And sometimes you think, well, you have a choice. You think, well, I don't want either of them. And sometimes that happens when you have too many parties, for example, occupying the central ground. It's like, well, they're all offering variations of the same kind of product. But what about the question about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? Can you be nostalgic about something that maybe wasn't wonderful either at the time or in hindsight?
I think you can, in the sense that I think that sometimes, well, it depends what you mean by negative experiences, but sometimes painful experiences can be enriching in certain ways, and might be happening in periods of time which are bigger than the actual experience itself, and so they're part of the story of that time. I mean, you know, even in terms of like relationships that broke down or lost love or whatever. I mean, I think fondly of those, even if recapturing them sometimes would recapture the kind of negativity of it.
I also remember when I interviewed our colleague Simon Kirchin a couple of years ago, and he made the very interesting point that it's possible to be nostalgic perhaps about relationships you didn't have. I thought that was really interesting, that sort of like pining for something. It doesn't have to be relationships, but something that...
Like alternative histories.
Yeah, but the idea that something could have happened, you know, back to the broken road syndrome, the back to the future syndrome, and I've recently watched, actually I saw it three times, Tenet, and each time I sort of... By the third time, I thought, yeah, second time I got it. Then the third time I thought, no, I'm back to where I was in the first viewing, which is the one I thought, no, I'm not going to see it a fourth. I sort of almost feel that's the limit. I've reached saturation point. But isn't that the same kind of thing, though, the idea that we're all doing that all the time? It's the sort of whether it did happen or it didn't happen or it might have happened or could have happened or might still happen again. They're all variations, almost on a daily basis sometimes, that we're having to negotiate.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think about some of the work that I do in kind of post-colonial writing, part of that is actually an attempt to excavate an alternative history that didn't happen. So for me, these moments, for instance, where something called Hinduism is labelled and is defined as a religion and therefore thrown into a box with Christianity and all of the assumptions of the Christian tradition about identity and so on, what would happen if that moment didn't happen or if a different point of translation occurred? And so what histories have been closed down when the history that we live in has opened up? So, you know, if we lived in a society that was dominated by Buddhist culture rather than Christian and post-Christian culture through the power of empire. And so I've always been interested in that question, going back to those historical moments and pulling open the concepts and imagining the world differently. And I think that must be what the humanities has to contribute to the moment that we're in now. It's how could we imagine the world differently from the way in which it's being imagined at the moment.
And a question that I asked you towards the beginning was really around whether you have fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young. So, you know, and I think it works both ways. What would your 5 or 15-year-old self think about what you're doing now? But also conversely, what would you say to your 5 or 15-year-old self based on what's happened in your life since?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I'd like to think I've still got things I can achieve. But yes, I mean, I'm quite content with the things that I have achieved, the books that I've written, the people's lives I've touched personally and professionally. So I think going back to when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, my main idea there was that I wanted to be an astronaut. And I think I would have to convince that young boy that what I'd done in my life was a kind of exploration of the universe in the world of ideas rather than necessarily in terms of physically going out and orbiting the planet and so on.
Yeah, so it shows what I was saying earlier about radio. In a sense, I'm doing the sort of thing through my podcast that I dreamt about doing when I was young, but you may not have physically gone to outer space, but you've been asking those penetrable questions, or those impenetrable questions, but, you know, trying to wrestle with them from the vantage point of intellectual thought.
Yes.
Yeah. Good. What about the question about friends from your past? Because obviously you've lived in lots of places and lots of countries. You mentioned Paris, you mentioned Tennessee, and obviously England and Scotland. So what are you still in touch? I suppose social media helps foment that. But what sort of friendship base have you sort of kept in touch with?
Well, that's an interesting question, because going back to the question of life being positive or negative, which is essentially also a question about regrets. I would say that because I've lived in so many different places, my friendship circle is kind of scattered in these different places. And sometimes when I look back on it, it feels like I've lived fragments of different people's lives. And the people who were important to me and still are important to me, but aren't in my everyday life now, are in those other places. And so, yes, it's easier to contact people now through social media and so on. And I think that, if I can say this about myself, I seem to be able to pick up with people quite easily, like not be in contact with them for a while and then kind of immediately get back into that kind of that contact. But I guess the strange thing about it reminds me of Edward Said in his autobiography. Edward Said, you know, he had a kind of multicultural upbringing, went to a kind of English school, was a Palestinian, then went to an American university. And he says in his autobiography that the only place he ever felt at home was inside a book. And as someone who is surrounded by books and has spent my life kind of exploring the world of ideas and so on, that speaks to me in the sense that in some sense, the place where I most feel at home is inside a book.
And my very last, very apt in terms of obviously what you then, we were just talking before we started interviewing about all your many books. What are you going to do with them? Because you've accumulated thousands over the years. But would you say, Rich, that you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Well, I also am someone who has a problem with binaries, and for a number of reasons, but also because I'm actually quite, I spent years studying Hindu and Buddhist philosophies that are non-dualistic in the sense that they reject like binary oppositions in their kind of construction of their understanding of the world. And I would say that probably, I think, again, classic answer here, I'm going to do now, by the way, what Kirk does when he in Star Trek, when he reinvents the Kobayashi test by cheating. He changes the rules so he can win. It's a test in Starfleet, geeking out here, where you can't win. It's a no-win scenario, and it's how you cope under pressure, and he changes the program so he can win. And so I'm going to reject the binary and say that actually the only way you can really look forward is by looking back. Because as someone who thinks that I'm of myself as a historian of ideas, I think that one of the problems in our culture, actually, is that we've stopped looking back. We've stopped understanding what it has been and is to be human. And from that, we've lost our sense of where we're going. So I think you have to look back to be able to know where you're going.
Yeah. And what a perfect answer. It's also put in mind something I was bizarrely listening to earlier. There's Klingons on the starboard now. Do you remember that from 1987?
I do.
Star Trek in across the universe. So I got that one in. Rich, it has been so amazing to catch up. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you.